Wilderness Safety: What to Do If You Get Lost in the Woods. The Maine Warden Service responds to hundreds of search and rescue calls every year. The most common call is for a lost hiker. It is really easy to get disoriented just by stepping off a trail. But people can and do get lost for all kinds of reasons. If you get lost in the Maine woods, would you know what to do? Would you have the supplies to survive overnight? Or would you just depend on your smartphone? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll discuss wilderness safety with two outdoor education experts. We'll also hear from a Maine game warden who has been involved in many search and rescues over the years. Staying alive in the great outdoors, what to know and what to teach your children. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. One of the many perks of living in Maine is, of course, the great outdoors. But when heading out to explore the wild areas of Maine, what do you need to keep in mind to stay safe? What would you do if you got lost? Well, today we're going to learn some experts' advice about wilderness safety. Joining me in the studio, Lori Gullion, who is an assistant clinical professor of outdoor education at the University of New Hampshire's Department of Kinesiology. Adam Williams is Assistant Director of the Outdoor Adventure Center at Unity College. And Tim Spar is a sergeant with the Maine Warden Service. As always, we want to hear from you. How do you keep yourself safe and sound when headed into Maine's great outdoors? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of wilderness safety, though, I want to ask each of you how you got into wilderness, this area. How did you become an avid outdoorsman or outdoorswoman and developed your passion for the outdoors? Lori, I was reading about you this morning. You lead Arctic wild whitewater expeditions.
I do.
That's brave.
Yes, it is. But it's absolutely wonderful to put yourself in a place for a month to 2 months and that you can't easily escape, but also have the skills so that you can have an absolutely marvelous experience in a gorgeous location.
Were you always an avid outdoorswoman?
I am. I grew up with a family who came to Maine a lot. My dad had a hunting and fishing cabin outside of Dover Foxcroft, up in the Sebeka area, and I grew up rambling in the woods, and I think we've lost a little bit of that recently, but I feel that I was enormously lucky to have that kind of childhood. My major in college had nothing to do with the outdoors, though. It was television and radio broadcasting and,
well,
and journalism.
Welcome.
That's right.
You have a great voice.
So it's a return in some ways, but I much prefer to be outdoors, and I was able to turn my hobbies at the time, after working as a news reporter, to sort of blend my two loves, which is writing about the outdoors, but also training other people in order to be out there and to keep that ripple effect going of getting more and more people outdoors and enjoying it, and also working on behalf of it to make sure we still have public places that are open to everybody.
That's great. Adam, what about you?
My first formative experiences were really not until later. I grew up in Maine and sort of had a secondary relationship with the outdoors until I went away to college and was inspired by moving to California and the vastness of the wilderness spaces out there. Got involved with some students and some outdoor programming at the college that I went to and had a first backpacking experience in college that completely blew me away. I was dealing with some stress in college, like many students are, and came back from just a three-day trip with a really new perspective on what I wanted to do. And that's sort of where it started for me, and it's sort of continued on since then.
So it's interesting. You didn't grow up an Eagle Scout or doing this kind of thing on your own.
No, I did not. Not in the least.
But later
actually.
In your life, yeah. And what about you, Sergeant Spar?
Well, I actually grew up in northeast Pennsylvania, and I was in the woods all the time. It was something I think probably my grades weren't that great when I was in grade school and junior high school because I just really couldn't wait to get in the woods. And that really had stuck with me my whole life, and I was fortunate enough to be able to jump into a career where I could stay in the woods.
Okay, and if your name sounds familiar to our audience, that's because you've gained fame through Northwoods Law.
That's
you
right,
recognized
yes.
everywhere you go now?
Well, you know, I think it's finally starting to slide a little bit, but it was quite a ride there for about 4 years. We always told people when they asked us if we were local celebrities, we would like to say that we were international film sensations because we were also seen in Canada.
I like that. Okay, so let's start. How easy is it to get lost?
It is, in my experience as being a game warden for 21 years, I think it's very easy to get lost. And the Maine Warden Service responds to about 400 searches a year. And those searches can be anybody just leaving their back porch and taking a walk in the woods to an unplanned trip on the Appalachian Trail where somebody gets really lost. And our searches can run anywhere from a few hours to several weeks. And so it's I myself have been lost simply getting out of the my own patrol vehicle and not taking a compass bearing when I darted off into the woods. And so it takes that initial awareness before you dart off into the woods to take a compass bearing, make sure you have some things with you and knowing where you are.
Adam, your bio says that you've led thousands of young people on wilderness adventures. How often have you dealt with somebody being lost?
Fortunately, not very often. And I think a part of that is this really good front loading on our end as educators to describe how easy it is to get lost, right? And to create plans and backup contingencies around how to stay found. That's the terminology we like to use a lot. What are you going to do if you find yourself in that position? What are the right things to do? I think part of the issue is that most people in their day-to-day life will, as an example, drive to a place and be multitasking and not know how they got there. So the way that we operate in our day-to-day life in society is not to really pay close attention to our surroundings. And that becomes essential when you move out of the realm of what's built and into the realm of what's much more natural. Yeah, I think through really good front loading, we can talk about sort of some of the specifics too and how you do that. For me, that's how I feel like I try to mitigate the risk of lost students.
Right. Because one can just step off of a trail in a wooded area to go to the bathroom, and then suddenly you think, wait, which way did I come from?
Yeah, and sadly, we've seen that happen. We know that happens.
Lori, I'm interested in something you said earlier connecting to something Tim just said. You said we don't grow up with the skills we used to. And Tim talks about jumping out of his truck without getting his compass bearing. Mm-hmm. How many people really know how to use a compass anymore?
That's true. And I think that the map skills that people used to have slackened as well. And as you spend a lot of time staring into the little map that you've got on your cell phone or into your GPS, you lose some of the abilities with spatial relationships that you strengthen through map reading. And we have students in the program who work very, very hard at the map reading now because of the fact that they're not really used to pulling out a DeLorme Atlas. In fact, I pulled one out on one experience as we were doing some research ahead of time to come up with a plan and to figure out where we were going to be with some very strategic information about mileage and elevation loss and gain. And somebody made a crack about the DeLorme Atlas being old school. And I said, it may be, but it is still the best tool that you could ever have, as well as knowing how to use a compass, because your cell phone may not work in the areas that you're traveling into. And we know in sections of Maine and New Hampshire that are pretty close to towns that there are huge gaps in cell service.
So you can't
rely on that. It has to be, I think, going back to what a lot of people would consider to be old school skills.
Yeah, we've been lost on logging roads, not even hiking or something, but just that, boy, they all start to look alike after a little bit. Are people over-dependent on the GPS and their cell phones?
In my opinion, yes. And I think having an awareness, first of all, being able to run a compass, as we say, in the warden service, and it's really the most reliable tool that you can have. You don't have to worry about batteries dying and other satellite coverage or whatever that may be. But also just having a general awareness. I think Adam just referred to that. Where is the sun when you leave from your point? Is it to your back? Is it to your side? being aware of different landmarks, so to speak, in the woods, a particular old growth tree that you may see again, or a granite formation or a rock outcropping. And those are the basic things that I think you really need to be aware. It's very easy to go into the woods and just go into some sort of, to think and not be aware of your surroundings. But it's really important, and not to always rely on an electronic device.
Well, and sure, you said you both have talked a little bit about multitasking. But one of the reasons lots of people go hiking or cross-country skiing is to sort of lose themselves and to get into a zone where you may not actually be noticing every landmark you go past. You wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think one thing that we were talking about earlier, the three of us, is I think we're in agreement that the first thing anyone can always do anytime they head out is to have a plan and have something written down. So at Unity College, where I work, our students are required to turn in paperwork. We call it an emergency response plan. It's got other verbiage, other names, and other places. It's traditionally the same thing. So we want to know where you're going, and this is for everyone to become practiced in. Where are you going? Where is emergency care in relation to where you are? Who are you calling or who are you communicating with when you get back so that they can know if they haven't gotten a call from you, then something's up. And they're going to know where you're at, your general itinerary. And that, for me, is where it starts. For even a day hike, it's nice to have that. And it might seem kind of cumbersome for something that's only going to last a few hours, but a day hike could become much longer, as we know. So,
go ahead, Laura.
I think that one of the things that's interesting about that kind of plan, which is so important, is that we think about that when we know that we're going to be out for an extended period of time, that might trigger the thought that that kind of information would be really important. What I think is interesting is when you step outside your door and you go off hiking in what has been a very well-known landscape to you, and you get turned around at that particular point, or you fall and risk an ankle break or something that you just didn't count on. So some of those experiences that are closer to home sometimes can be more problematic. And I think that when anybody is heading out on what they might perceive to be a short tour should really go out as if they need to sustain themselves for an extended period of time. So having adequate clothing, food, and water, even if I'm going out for an hour, I always have that with me in a backpack along with a compass and a map for the area that I'm in.
That was going to be one of my questions, to ask you what you take with you. If you're just going out on a couple-hour hike, what is in your backpack, Laura? You said a compass, water, some food.
I have insulating clothing in case I need to sit on the ground and stay warm. I usually have a short piece of a foam pad that I could actually sit on to insulate myself from the ground. I've got weatherproof layers, and that just happens to be in a day pack that I always have in the closet that I can grab as I go out the door, or I've got it in my car if I'm driving somewhere. I always think about the fact that if I needed to be sitting in the woods for an extended period of time, perhaps overnight, would I be able to keep myself warm until I could get help or someone could find me?
Sergeant Spar, I want to ask you about what to do if you do get lost. I used to be a daily news reporter. I remember being out on search and rescue stories, and so often wardens were just hopeful that the person was going to stay put. Because you do a grid search, correct?
Yes. Well, let me say first, though, just to add on to what Laurie said, is that never, when you're going on a hike, never underestimate your terrain. We had a situation one time where somebody left Portland around 11 o'clock in the morning with the intent of climbing, hiking into a remote pond in Grafton Notch and being home in Portland by dinner time. Of course, we had to go and find them. So that's really important, to be able to know what you're getting into before you get into it. But what you need to do if you are lost is you need to first stay still. Set yourself up in a situation where you're relatively protected, but also where you can be seen, mostly from the air. So
if there's a clearing...
If there's a clearing, a rock outcropping, I just read an article of an individual that was lost in Yosemite for 6 days, And he did everything correctly. He found a waterfall that was an opening. He had packed his food and was able to start a fire. It took him, and this was in the middle of the winter. And he was able to be located. And when he was located, he was fine. So starting a fire, creating, building yourself a shelter, but also in a way that you can be seen. And don't move. And also, if you have a cell phone, make your initial call, 911 call, and then don't hang on the phone. I can't tell you how many times I've been called to a search where the state police dispatch has the number, and I try to call that person back, and they're on the phone talking to somebody. Once that cell phone battery dies, then we're in really trouble. We can ping a cell phone, meaning we can get a GPS coordinate if they call 911. So, but very, very important. Make your 911 call and then just put the cell phone down and wait for calls that come to you.
Mm. Adam, you talked about front loading. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So there's this idea of, like, you know, risk management on any type of these programs that we run at Unity College or Lori runs at University of New Hampshire, that Tim's dealing with people that he's finding or looking for, lost people. And the more you can do ahead of time to know what you are getting yourself into and to be able to have open conversations about what might be a potential risk associated with what you're doing allows you to just sort of have a contingency plan. And that's really important. I think where people find themselves in danger or precarious situations is when they don't know what they don't know. When they go into a situation not knowing that there's more they could have learned before they went out, before they set off to try some really unique challenge for the first time. And I think, you know, we can talk about this at length later, potentially. Just what are the types of trainings people should be looking into to feel like they're adequately prepared for anything outdoors, really.
I want to talk briefly. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I think one of the things that's interesting for folks is when they underestimate the particular conditions on a given day. And I do a lot of water sports training and water sports activities and been on some river searches. And they often happen in the springtime when the air temperature is incredibly warm. It's a gorgeous day, but the water temperature is still incredibly cold and rivers are often running higher than they normally do in the summertime. Somebody might get on a stretch of river that might be in their backyard that they're very used to. But the warm air temperature and the cold water fools them into believing that things might be okay. And I think we need to be really cautious sometimes about some of the environmental conditions that we take for granted and just always look at things with a fresh eye.
Even places you've been before many
right.
times.
Yep.
Well, what an interesting conversation. I have so many more questions for you, but I have to take a break. So if you'd like to join the conversation about being safe outdoors, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does New England Cancer Specialists, committed to leading the way to better outcomes for 50 years. More at newenglandcancerspecialists.org.
Congress is about to meet for the first time since the deadly school shooting in Parkland, Florida.
We're going to introduce legislation to make sure that assault weapons are illegal.
Legislation to prevent bump stocks.
Changing our background system.
How much could those policies prevent future mass shootings? The potential impact of proposed gun control laws this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Later today on This American Life, when David Sedaris's cat died, his family helped him deal with the loss.
My mother sent a consoling letter along with a check to cover the cost of the cremation. In the left-hand corner, under the heading marked memo, she'd written, pet burning.
When animals attack our hearts. Pet stories, that's later today.
Join us tonight at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Staying Safe in the Great Maine Outdoors. Joining me today, Lori Gulyad, I'm sorry, Laurie, Associate Clinical Professor of Outdoor Education at UNH's Department of Kinesiology. Adam Williams, Assistant Director of the Outdoor Adventure Center at Unity College, and Sergeant Tim Spar with the Maine Warden Service. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. On the line with us now, Bill Brook. He is outings chair for the Appalachian Mountain Club and also a maintainer and board member for the Maine Appalachian Trail Club. Bill, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thanks, Jennifer.
I understand the main section of the ATC is one of the most difficult stretches of the trail. What safety precautions does the AMC recommend for people interested in hiking on the ATC, the main stretch?
It would be, in general, pretty much the standard hiking precautions. A lot of the through hikers coming through, though, in particular, as was mentioned previously, a lot of Maine, the cell coverage is spotty or non-existent, and which is not true on a lot of the Appalachian Trail in the southern part. So, they should actually have a map versus using their phone for dependency, and also be prepared, for any kind of a self-rescue or emergency contingency, to self-rescue themselves versus just calling somebody on the phone because the trailheads, the trail's a long distance from help usually.
You all found recently that there's an overdependence on phones?
For us, that's what I know a lot of the through hikers use apps now for, direction on the Appalachian Trail for us. The other thing in Maine in particular, there's a lot of unbridged stream crossings, and I think it was previously mentioned after a rain, those streams can come up very quickly, and some of them are fairly large, the Pleasant River, over by Gulf Haggis, can be very treacherous. The other thing is staying on the trail. In Maine, the trail is where it is probably because, in a lot of places, because that's the only place it could go. So getting off the trail can be dangerous with that.
Well, Bill, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, in Maine, the streams look very clean and clear, but we always recommend everyone treat the water. So.
Oh, thanks for saying that. That was going to be one of my questions for this crew here. So no matter how clear it looks, how early in springtime, don't drink it without treating it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, just to be safe, you never know. So.
All right. Well.
Be treated.
Thank you so much for calling in. That was Bill Brook with the Appalachian Mountain Club and the Maine Appalachian Trail Club. I'm going to start with a Facebook post. This is Nathan. He says, I got lost a few years ago, close to dark, luckily finding my way out. But it spurred me to take a course at the Maine Primitive Skills School in Augusta. It was a great experience. And now with a tarp, some twine, a knife, and some fire steel, I feel confident I could spend the night in most situations. I'd encourage everyone to take such a course just for the peace of mind. And, that's what started this whole program, Adam. Unity College is another place that has courses that not just students there can take, correct?
Yeah, we have a wide offering of courses through our certification and training center that both students and community members can take advantage of. Everything from really basic first aid and CPR for the lay responder, and also more advanced 80-hour wilderness first responder courses, which are really delving deeply into preparing yourself for an emergency situation in the wilderness, which we define. We know that we have this critical hour window, the golden hour, right? That's what happens when there's any trauma to any patient. We're trying to get them to definitive medical care in an hour. If you're outside of 2 hours, you're considered in a wilderness context. And that seems like it's a far place or a long distance, but I can tell you right now, if it's snowing, if there's any inclement weather whatsoever, the distance increases exponentially for how far and how long it is for you to find that medical care. So these are the types of courses we offer that are really, really beneficial that will help people get trained and feel confident in the outdoors.
Yeah, and I've noticed some others do. I know Chewonky offers some classes, and you're nodding, Lori. I mean, if you Google outdoor survival, or outdoor safety, or outdoor first aid, wilderness first aid, all sorts of really interesting classes going on out there. I want to talk before we go back to some more calls about first aid, and I'm going to confess that I had an experience hiking in Lubeck in a state park early in the morning before I was going to go out on a shoot for a story, and tripped and fell and hurt my knee and suddenly felt so dumb because I didn't see another soul as I limped back out of that state park. And I thought, what if I had broken my leg? And what struck me, and Sergeant Spar, I'm sure you've seen this hundreds of times, and this is no surprise, is that I was in I was Quoddyhead State Park, a very popular state park. So these kind of things can happen anywhere. What kind of first aid would you have recommended for dumb me that day to have taken with me on my hour-long hike?
I would think that anybody who's hiking in the woods would have a first aid kit that was applicable to their knowledge of first aid. I don't think you would want to get too advanced on treatment unless you had a particular training for that. But anything that would at least get you back to a place where you could be treated by professionals is what you would really need to do.
You're looking at some antiseptic, some Band-Aids, and maybe some wrap?
I think that's about it. Yeah, I think too. And, and just have a basic understanding. If you were really in a bad situation, like you had a broken leg, you may want to have the concept of how to make a splint to get yourself out. And that might take you a while, and I'm sure it would be quite painful. But if you were really in a situation where you had to do that, you would be able to do that with raw material mostly that you would be able to find in the woods, but you would still need some tapes and things like that. But I think it would be mostly what you were felt comfortable doing.
Lori, what do you have in your backpack?
I do have a small first aid kit that I travel with me, and a lot of it has to do with bleeding control and things like ACE bandages in order to contain an ankle or a hand or something that I might need to wrap to reduce swelling until I get out. Depending upon personal needs as well, it's always important to have personal medications that somebody might really need. An asthma inhaler that's full, and epinephrine for anyone in your family that has any kind of an allergy. And bee sting allergies are increasingly common among people who've never had a reaction before. So I've found that certainly the families that I'm traveling with, when we're going out with kids, we've got actually a fair number of supplies in the event that we need to respond to something in the woods. And I think Maine is poised with a great opportunity to have first aid courses accessible because of Wilderness Medical Associates. So anyone can take a basic 16-hour Wilderness first aid course and be incredibly well prepared to care for themselves and their families for being outdoors. It's an absolutely great resource that's available here in the state.
I also think it's important to note that many times the first people to arrive on a rescue might not be medical people. Game wardens, for example, are not medical people. So I think Lori is absolutely right. Being prepared to treat yourself at your competence level is certainly the way to go.
We'll go to Dave, who's calling from Manchester. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. I fly with the Civil Air Patrol, and we occasionally are called upon to aid the Maine Warden Service in search and rescue missions. We carry a fairly elaborate emergency pack in the plane with us, but three of the things that we feel are quite important that somebody can just slip into their pocket very easily are signaling devices, like a whistle, like a coach's whistle, or a mirror. A mirror can be seen for miles from the air, just a tiny little compact mirror, or you can buy, at L.L. Bean, a signaling mirror. And matches, of course, because if you light a smoky fire and somebody's looking for you, they'll find it.
Well, thanks so much for those tips, Dave. And as you were talking, Adam was nodding away.
Yeah, Dave makes a great point. This discussion, we were talking about the personal things we would bring with us for any type of an outing. And I think my students often laugh when we're going out together and it's 9 a.m. and I've packed a headlamp with spare batteries, because that's what I'm thinking of, the time overnight that we might have to spend out there. And then some sort of fire starting device, whether it be matches, flint and steel, a lighter works great. If you're like our primitive skill friend who, wrote on Facebook, then you can bring your tinder and, bust a coal if you want. That's great too. That's all really, really relevant. And those ancestral skills are very applicable, and having a good foundation of those helps too.
All right, Dave, thanks for calling in. We're going to go to Sloan, who's calling from Deer Isle. Hi, Sloan, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to mention the importance of making sure that people are safe in the water and the importance of capsize drills so that people don't panic. If, for example, their kayak overturns or they're in a sailboat that goes over suddenly, that cutting down on the shock and the panic that ensues really lends itself usually to a better outcome and a better ability to make decisions.
Lori?
I absolutely agree with Sloan. I teach a lot of water sports, and at UNH we make sure that people's rescue skills keep pace with their paddling skills and the difficulty of the water that they're going to travel into. And right from the beginning, making sure that you're able to get away from the boat that you're in and then know what to do from that point to rescue yourself, but also be in a position where other people can come in and assist you with a rescue. They can't help you unless you've begun to execute a self-rescue. So the comfort that she's talking about is incredibly important when you're in the water to know what to do next.
Sloan, thanks so much for calling. And isn't generally, as Sloan was talking about, not panicking, isn't trying to keep yourself from panicking one of the essentials if you do find yourself confused or lost or disoriented?
Yeah, we were discussing this earlier. I think the lost part, there's this sense of dread that sinks in that makes people do objectively sort of irrational things or things that maybe are not the best for them. And I know I'm sure Tim has seen this ample times. And that idea of staying calm, knowing that it'll pass, and that if you have the right supplies, you can survive plenty long without food and plenty long without a lot of water. And that getting through the night, waking up in daylight definitely helps psychologically get over the fear that sets in. It's a very real thing, and it's much easier said than done. Yeah.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for this program. You guys have basically been telling my story that I'd like to give you a little bit of detail from a very long night that I spent in the woods up at my camp in New Gloucester, kayaking the Royal River the spring after the ice storm. And needless to say, it was very cold. It was early April. And I, for additional perspective, I'm a physician assistant. I winter camp. I've done the 100-mile wilderness. I worked with Wilderness Medical Associates and Outward Bound. And I was a Boy Scout once long ago, and I should have known better. There was a lot that I did right in terms of having left a message with my neighbor that if I wasn't, my lights weren't on by the night, that maybe he should come look for me. But I definitely, as one of your guests shared, went about it way too casually. I just thought I was going for a short little trip down the Royal River. And there was more trees down than there was water, and I was out of the boat a lot. And I went around a corner, and the only pair of glasses that I had brought with me got caught with a branch, and I was blind.
Oh.
And that comment that was just made about the sense of dread went straight up through me because I knew I was in serious trouble, and all I wanted to do was run. And fortunately, I was able to adhere to what I trained people along the way, which was to stay right where I was, because I knew there was still snow on the ground. I knew that I would stumble. I knew that I would break something. And just for a couple more details, not to monopolize this, but I had the warden service yelling my name in the middle of the night, very, very cold. They could not hear me. I could hear them. The topography and the sound just didn't work. I had a helicopter go over top, and I was very upset that they didn't have lights, but they were actually using infrared looking for me, but I had covered myself with branches and stuff to try to keep my body heat in because I was freezing cold. So they never saw me. They actually thought I was upside down underneath my boat. And the next morning, after, again, a very long night in the woods, I was carried out on the back of a very sweet warden across a body of water because I just literally could not move.
Well, Bob, thanks for your story, yeah. And I think it's instructive because you do have so much experience. Sergeant Spar.
I think I was actually on that, sir, so I'm glad that Bob has pleasant memories of it.
Yeah.
That's a tough time, tough situation. But I can, what Bob describes is that he actually, in that circumstance, overcame that panic and stayed at one place and figured it out until an aircraft or wardens on the ground were able to find him. So that's an example. That's a success story.
Sure. Go ahead, Lori.
It is very clear when you take a look at accident reports from a lot of different places in New England that the people who stay emotionally collected, especially if they're out overnight, if they stay warm and sometimes active and just to stay up all night moving and moving around to make sure that they are maintaining some semblance of warmth, and they do a variety of different activities and exercises to keep themselves relatively under control, that they survive those experiences incredibly well.
Interesting.
More than somebody who gives up.
Interesting. Well, yeah. Bob, thanks so much for calling in. And there's I do have to go to a break, but I want to read a related Facebook post. This is from Amy. When I got lost a couple years ago after following the wrong trail down a mountaintop in western Maine, I was unprepared for how quickly panic set in and affected my decision-making ability. I made so many mistakes that I was fortunate to find my way back to the trail after about 2 hours. The experience gave me new respect for the word. I was unprepared for how quickly panic set in and affected my decision-making ability. I mistakenly thought I could rely on my phone's map app to get me out safely, and I was fortunate to find my way back to the trail after about 2 hours. The experience gave me new respect for the woods and how easy it is to get turned around. On that note, we are going to take another quick break. Talking about wilderness safety, this is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does MEMIC, celebrating 25 years of working with employers and employees to reduce workplace injuries. On the web at MEMIC.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, the best of times or the worst of times.
The world might be better off than it used to be, but a lot worse than the world we expected to be living in when the Cold War ended.
Stephen Walt delivers the keynote address at the recent 31st Annual Camden Conference. This year's theme is New World Disorder and America's Future. That's coming up on the next Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
To hear this week's Camden Conference Speaking in Maine programs at your convenience, visit mainepublic.org and click on radio.
On the next Fresh Air, cartoonist and essayist Tim Kreider. In his new collection of personal essays, he writes about riding a circus train to Mexico with a friend, pretending to be her husband, having a whirlwind romance with a performance artist and prostitute, and about his beloved cat, who turned him into someone who believes
a man without a cat is not a man.
Join us
tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Staying Safe in the Great Outdoors. Joining me today, Maine Game Warden Tim Spar, Sergeant. Adam Williams is Assistant Director of the Outdoor Adventure Center at Unity College. And Lori Gullion is Associate Clinical Professor of Outdoor Education at UNH's Department of Kinesiology. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Sergeant Spar, we've been talking a lot about how to keep oneself safe. What if someone you know has gone missing and you're worried they may be lost in the woods? What's the best course of action? How does one find them?
If you're somebody that's with somebody, either at a house or other place that has gone missing, your initial steps are going to be very important as to the rest of the search. What you shouldn't do is conduct an extensive search on your own until other searchers get there. That'll contaminate an area. Generally, what we do is we bring in canines as quickly as we can. What really would help for that person to do is to identify what we call a scent article in the house, a piece of clothing that person who is missing war and put that in a or just leave it alone and close the door of the person's room, the canine handler is then able to come and isolate that as a scent article and use it for the search. That's the first part of the search. If we have too much activity into that area behind a house or in any other parts of woods, that can contaminate that area and our dogs will become less effective. So that's number one.
So at what point, maybe you're at a camp with your family and someone goes missing, you know, you go out, you holler that person's name, no response, maybe go to the beach they like to go to, they're not there. At what point do you say, this is when I need to call the warden service or a local authority?
I think if it's unusual or if the person is very young or very old or has any type of health issue, I would make a call as soon as you feel that things aren't
sooner,
right.
Not later.
Sooner, not later, correctly.
Adam?
Correct.
I think it's important, and I think that I agree completely with what's been said. And I think it's important to distinguish the front country setting and the back country setting a little bit because in a group in a backcountry setting, there are also protocols to follow that would include setting up a hasty search amongst your group members. Not doing it alone, but doing it in pairs or teams of three or larger. And once you've completed that, really kind of, because you are at it, you know, if you are in a wilderness environment, you're potentially hours from the warden service coming to find you. And you do have to be proactive if you're a part of a group looking for a lost individual. So we typically teach setting up smaller groups for a hasty search, which is a quick search in either direction, and then setting up a much larger, more thorough search that can last as long as it can take to find the individual or until you can meet with responders coming to find you.
Okay. We're going to go. Let's see here. So many calls. We'll go to Paul in Springvale. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer and experts. How are you? I want to relate a story that happened to me quite a few years back while hiking out in the Kank, which is, pretty barren area at times. I did a hike and got out there and decided to come back. It was late October. Light wasn't much. I started late. Decided that on the way back, I stumbled over this logging trail. I said, I'm going to go that way because the trail going out was boggy and wet, and I was into mud up to my knees. So I followed that logging trail all the way along, and then it terminated, and there was this sign, which is kind of the funny part of this, which was painted on it, said, "Now, don't you wish you stayed on the trail, stupid?" And I was like, it was getting dark, and I should have been mad, but all I did was laugh. I had a compass. I got a basic reading. Just kind of trod along through the woods, found a little dry riverbed, which led me to the Swift River. Walked down that for about a half mile or so, which led me back onto the Kank, and then had to walk back to my car 2.5 miles, which was up on the top of Bear Notch Road. So, stay off the logging roads. You can get lost on those. And another thing which I didn't do is let anyone know where I was. It was pretty dark when I got there, and it was cold. And that's my story. Stay off those logging roads.
I'll second that. Thank you, Paul. We'll go to Brian calling from Jefferson. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hi. I was going to do a shout out for the Maine Search and Rescue. Anybody can join. And we need more volunteers. I'm a search and rescue volunteer, a Red Cross volunteer, a Unity alum. So it's really important that people get involved with MASAR and learn the basic search and rescue techniques. And the one thing I'm seeing a lot of, especially being a wilderness instructor, is people hiking without maps, especially in the whites. And buying a Dolorum or buying even a roadside atlas is better than nothing. And I've been seeing a lot of that lately and having a whistle to be able to signal. But join your search and rescue and learn about how to run a compass and read a map is so critical nowadays.
And Sergeant Spar, I know you wanted to talk about a lot of the community partners that the Warden Service works with.
Yeah, Maine Search and Rescue is certainly one of our number one organizations that we call when we need help. But I'd like to name a few other ones here. The Mahoosick Mountain Club in the Rangeley area, they are the first ones we call when we're when we need help. In York County Search and Rescue, Durango Search and Rescue, Waldo County Search and Rescue, and MASAR Dogs. The MASAR has a team of canine handlers, of which we also have a retired warden on that team, and they are just phenomenal. We use them all the time, and they're very effective. Can't say enough.
Thank you, Brian. We'll go to Doug calling from Peaks Island. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great show.
Great. Go ahead.
There?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So years ago, I lived in Colorado, and at the time, in order to get a hunting license, you were required to take hunter safety. And at the time, I was kind of poo-pooing it. I thought, I don't need this. This is, I know everything I need to know out there, but I learned an amazing amount, and I'm really glad I took it. And one of the key things that I took away from it was the importance of being aware of hypothermia. Even when the weather seems great, when you leave, where you start your day out in the woods, it can turn unpredictably, just like it does here in Maine. And they always recommended to carry a space blanket because, as you know, it can get very cold very quickly, and you can get rained on, and the wind can come up. And so I always anticipate that when I go out in the Maine woods. And I've gotten turned around plenty of times in the Maine woods myself, never gotten lost because I've always carried a compass. And I've always carried a map also and understood where I was relative to the major roads around.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug, thanks for calling in. A space blanket part of your backpack, Lori?
No, I go with the low-cost approach, and trash bags work really well. They do the same thing in terms of an ability to keep you dry and an ability to keep you warm. So pretty light, they can reduce the poundage that you're carrying on your back.
Doug, thank you. We'll squeeze in a call from Michelle in Penobscot. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I just want to take a moment to stress the importance of letting somebody know where you're going. And your time frame. My son was doing a project for L.L. Bean a few summers ago, doing time-lapse video of some of the more iconic spots in Maine, Acadia and Baxter and the Western Mountains. And he would go as far as taking photographs of the trail's head. He'd show me where he parked and what his plan was. So, you know, being the nervous mom, I knew when to expect him to call me back and let me know where he was. But should anything have ever happened, which very fortunately it never did, we knew right where to go and how to tell somebody to find him.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I've learned from experience that I actually do not use my mom as the call person now. I think she might be listening, so sorry about that.
On an Appalachian Trail entries, too, there's also an itinerary box, which if you're trekking out for the day, it's great if you could leave a note of what your plans are, because that's where wardens and searchers will show up to initiate a search if somebody is overdue.
Yeah, I wanted to actually, if it's okay, the last caller, we talked about hypothermia. We haven't really talked a whole lot about cold-related injuries or just seasonal injuries, environmental injuries. And I think it's really important to understand for this idea of wilderness safety, how your body works with the environment that you're in. Right now, stressing the fact that we still have some ice out, we still have a lot of people enjoying the ice. There's still risk for people falling through the ice, getting cold and wet, losing body heat that way. But it doesn't take a freezing cold day and freezing cold water to become hypothermic. 95 degrees or so, core temperature is looking at hypothermia. We're usually around 98. That's average for most people. Once you get down just a couple of degrees, you're in hypothermia, which is not a pleasant place to be. So understanding signs and symptoms of that, understanding treatment and also prevention is incredibly important, especially in these seasons that are, we take them a little bit for granted. We had a 65 degree day last week. People are out in shorts, and then it cooled down to the 20s overnight. And I think these are the seasons where people get in a little bit of trouble with hypothermia.
All right. Michelle, thanks for your call. Lori, I want to ask you, for parents out there, what to teach your kids? What simple things can you teach your kids? I'm going to guess, teach them how to use a compass, read a map.
I think starting with the map is the first place to begin, because that's a little bit easier to do than sort of the technical aspects of a compass, but the compass can offer them a great opportunity to practice something a little bit more challenging, which can be really rewarding. I think that developing awareness of the environment in which you're walking is important. It's a bit like tracking animals and looking while you're hiking, while you're walking. If you can have your kids really looking at the trees and the flowers, the rocks, and paying attention to those kind of markers, then it builds very good skills, very good spatial relationships for knowing where you are. And I think that they develop that excellent sense that helps them develop comfort. And if they're that aware and the family gets off track in any way, the kids can actually be marvelous help in terms of figuring out how to get home. Mm. Because they're so curious and they want to touch everything and they want to explore a lot of different things, they gather all kinds of information that sometimes adults can overlook. So I found that to be fascinating to watch the kids actually do really well with orienteering.
Mm.
Yeah.
Tim, so many Maine kids have read Lost on a Mountain in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Great story.
Yes, I think it's a great story. And I think it covers a lot of the things that we're talking about today. And I was actually just thinking about that before we came in, how his mind was thinking about what he was allowed to take out of this cabin. He was lost for days at that point, and he ended up in a cabin and didn't take survival equipment because he was concerned that that might be stealing or the wrong thing. So I found that type of thinking when you've been alone and lost might lend itself to some perhaps irrational thinking. So I think that's a great book to read for anybody to get a sense of what it would like to be lost in the wilderness. And
except he moved. He didn't stay put.
Exactly. Right. He would have probably been better off to stay at that cabin that he was in for a while and start a fire, and the smoke in the chimney would have located him.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for being here today and talking about this. I know we've really only scratched the surface. What we'll do is I'll ask all of you for information about clinics and classes, and I'll put those on our Facebook page. Joining us today, Sergeant Tim Sparr with the Maine Game Warden Service, Lori Gullion, Assistant Clinical Professor of Outdoor Education at UNH, and Adam Williams, Assistant Director at the Outdoor Adventure Center at Unity College. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our archives at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to discuss palliative care. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.